Welcome to Talks Around a Farm Table, a podcast about the diverse landscape of agriculture on Kodiak Island. This series is driven by Kodiak Soil Water Conservation District in collaboration with KMXT Radio. I am your host, Ian Zacher. Hello, farmers, gardeners, and ranchers. On today's episode, we've got a guest from Homer Soil and Water Conservation District, Monica Kopp. She is the agricultural coordinator in Homer's Water District, and she's going to give us a little bit of about what she's been up to over there. So go ahead, Monica.
Yeah, hi, everyone. Thanks for having me, Ian. Great to be on here. So my name is Monica Kopp, and I'm the agriculture coordinator for Homer Soil and Water Conservation District. And for those of you who don't know what Soil and Water Conservation Districts do, we are sort of a quasi-government agency. So our mission at Homer Soil and Water is to provide education and leadership in the conservation and sustainable use of soil and water related resources through cooperative programs that protect, restore, and improve our environment. So we have programs in invasive species, habitat and trails, and a native plants program, in addition to my own program, which is agriculture. But our other programs are sort of more self-contained, and the work is out in the field related to specific user groups and that sort of thing. But the agriculture program maintains and staffs a public-facing office in town, and anyone can walk in and get resources on growing food and agricultural products. So we're really kind of, we end up being the face of Homer Soil and Water. Sometimes people come in with habitat and trails related concerns or questions, or native plant related questions. So we kind of help point people into the direction of those resources, but most of what we do is agriculture related. So our ag program vision is to support a thriving farmer network that encourages sharing of experiences, resources, and knowledge, and to foster new and beginning farmers and to feed our community with equitable access to healthy and local foods in a way that contributes positively rather than taking away from the ecosystem. So like I said, everything we do as a conservation district is soil and water related, focused on protecting those resources. But what that really means for your everyday grower is that we're really just looking to help you grow food in a way that nourishes and rather than degrades soil, and in ways that prevent pollutants like nitrogen or phosphorus runoff from entering waterways. And what that really means is that we're just basically trying to help people grow more food more efficiently and sustainably. So it just so happens that all of our staff are really enthusiastic about helping our state become more food sovereign and growing food. And so anything we can do to connect you with resources is something we're really heavily invested in. So our office, we've maintained a public-facing office on Pioneer Avenue, downtown Homer, for a long time, since before my day. I started in 2021 with the district, and I honestly don't know how long we've been around, but I think we've been a pretty strong resource in town for a number of years, decades. There was sort of a high tunnel boom back right around 2010, I believe, 2010 to 2015. And our district manager, Kyra Wagner, was really heavily involved in getting the word out about the high tunnel program that the Natural Resources Conservation Service has, where they provide cost share for high tunnels. And so she really promoted that program heavily and really tried to get high tunnels in like everybody's backyard in Homer. And so as a result, we became known as the high tunnel capital of the world. And I don't know the exact numbers, but we do have more high tunnels per capita than anywhere else, at least in the country that we're aware of. So kind of a fun thing. You just run into people in town and strike up a conversation, and most of the time it ends up revolving around your high tunnel. Which is a pretty fun thing.
Yeah,
our office has lots of resources. We're just there to like answer questions about everything from like how to start your first garden to, you know, commercial producers with more complex issues. We also have a soil testing program. So folks can bring in their soil and we will ship it out to a lab and then provide a personalized soil recommendation, nutrient recommendation for what kind of fertilizers and how much lime to put on your garden for everything from like your first time breaking ground, brand new garden to, you know, something that's been grown in for years and years. And that's a really fun program. I've been working with that program for going on 5 years now, and it's just a great way to get to know folks and their soil and to see trends. If people test their soil every year, to start to see, you know, different soil levels rising or falling and, you know, key in on potential problems. And it's just a really great kind of introduction to working with a producer more closely. So we also have a tool lending library, which is kind of cool. We rent out broad forks and cultivating hose and a soil probe for testing soil, and that's all for free. We have a big library of books, too, that you can borrow. So we just try to be here as a resource for growers, for anybody from the backyard grower to, like, you know, commercial peony growers, rhodiola, hay, all that stuff. That's kind of what we're up to over here.
Yeah, that's pretty intense. I can assure you that that we are also a bit of a hoop house consortium over here as well. From my understanding from the NRCS side is that they use Kodiak originally as like their intern practice spot, as like a testing spot for Alaska for the hoop house program. And what was interesting is when they first introduced them, they didn't really have the qualifications that you need to, like, the prerequisites that they do now. And that they actually paid you to do some IPM. So there was, like, I know, like, some of the first people that got to their hoop houses here, they got some stipend for picking slugs out of their garden, which I thought was pretty cool. Yeah, because Kodiak has a lot of slugs. So, what would be nice to talk about is, like, what you personally see in Homer, because here in Kodiak, we don't have a lot of large growers that you do. Like, you got the Homer Hill up there where you just got all large peony growers and just large veg producers. You guys got a very beautiful farmer's market that's got lots of diversity there. And some of the things that I think that we have in common between Kodiak and Homer is at least the districts are here to service people. And I think what's interesting about the districts is that it is the approachability of us compared to, like, having to go to NRCS and, like, go to their corporate office or, like, and there's not even an NRCS office in Homer, is there? Is there?
You do have an NRCS office. We actually share a space. We have kind of separate rooms or different separate offices, but we're in the same building. We're right across the hall from one another.
Yeah, we don't have an NRCS office here. I am the NRCS face for Kodiak. We, too, don't have an extension agent service here. We act as the agents a lot of times, the extension service. But what type of things do you see going on in Homer that you think might be interesting here for Kodakians? I know that you have a lot of hoop houses over there. So what are the type of growing operations that you deal with on a day-to-day basis?
Lots and lots of backyard gardens. I mean, as far as, you know, soil testing is sort of the primary way how I interact with people, whether they walk into the office, strike up a conversation, or I see their results and see some issues or something, and I call them up and chat about it a little bit more. Vast majority of those are backyard gardens, but we also have a number of micro farms, like you mentioned, the farmers market, all those growers. And then we have a handful of, you know, more what I would call medium-sized farms, but what, you know, the Farm Service Agency would still probably call micro farms, but, you know, properties of 9 acres or so, growing space, maybe more like 1 acre. And then we have a number of peony farms, a couple of rhodiola farms, And then lots of little livestock operations, you know, mostly backyard scale, but a few more commercial, very small scale, you know, goats and pigs and poultry. And then we have the Fox River Cattlemen, who have a big state lease out at the head of the bay. And so they actually do quite a bit of work with NRCS. They did a virtual tracking project where they put like little GPS ear tags on their cattle so that they could monitor their movements across the flats and sort of understand better like the impact of cattle being out there in that watershed. And then, yeah, a little bit of hay production, pasture management, that kind of thing. So that's sort of a snapshot of agriculture in our area. And, you know, we serve the whole Southern Peninsula. So there's another soil water conservation district in Kenai. And then our boundaries basically go from Clam Gulch south. You know, so we encompass Nanilchik, Anchor Point, Homer, and then all of the communities out East End Road towards the head of the bay. And then we also serve Seldovia, Port Graham, and Nanwalek.
You service a lot of people.
We do. I think the population of the South Peninsula is about 10,000, if I'm remembering that correctly.
You've got all these farmers. Like, what are the struggles there that they've got? And I'm sure it's mostly weather related. But what are some of the things that you find repeatedly and common with some of the troubles that these growers have in Homer?
Yeah, I think every grower struggles with something a little different around here. Certainly slugs are persistent, but they're not anything like what I've heard Kodiak is like. Do you guys have that black European slug, or is it?
We've got all the slugs. We've got all the great slugs. We've got the little itty bitty ones. We've got the leopard slugs. We've got the brown slugs, and they all seem to like your bok choy and mostly your brassicas. Like, I hear a lot of people griping about their cabbage, and you know, they're not so much broccoli, but the cauliflower they go after. But we also are the only place in Alaska that has, I think it's right now, it's three different types of garden snails that's been recorded.
Oh, no.
Yeah. So we're trying to keep a good lookout at it. That's why I'm always asking, like, do you guys get garden snails?
Yeah. Not that I'm aware of. I've never heard of anybody having them here. Yeah.
Yeah.
And even with slugs, I mean, they can be pretty bad, and I know folks who have thrown in the towel on growing cabbage and bok choy and like Napa cabbage just because they hit them so hard. But it's definitely something that some people are able to control, and like the commercial growers, I know a few of them who buy sluggo by the 50-pound bag and like religiously add that stuff every 10 days sometimes to control slugs. But we're lucky we don't have like the European black slug yet. So yeah, always keeping an eye out for that. Other pests, kind of just it depends on the grower and what they struggle with. You know, spider mites can be an issue in like apple orchards and greenhouse crops, and aphids kind of come and go. I know this year was a pretty big aphid year for a lot of people. Botrytis and other fungal pathogens, especially with peonies, is a big issue. I'm sure you guys struggle with the same thing. I mean, it's just so wet here that you get a lot of fungus.
Yeah, we get a lot of downy mildew, especially like on apple trees that are grown outside.
Interesting.
Yeah. What do people use over there to deal with that kind of stuff?
With apples?
Yeah.
I'm not aware of downy mildew being an issue with apples, but I would say a lot of folks grow all their fruit, or well, tree fruit in particular in high tunnels. I do think they do better, but lower elevation farms can get away with growing them outside, especially in just a really ideal, you know, south facing, sheltered from the wind, like ideal microclimate. There's some pretty nice orchards in town. I've heard this as a rule of thumb, like above, what is it, 600 or 900 feet elevation, you should just have them in a high tunnel. But that said, like I'm at 650 feet and I just planted an orchard outside because I didn't want to deal with, you know, having to prune to keep it inside a high tunnel and or like maintaining a high tunnel for that long. I know too many people whose apples outgrew their high tunnel and now they just don't have plastic on their high tunnel anymore.
So, kind of defeats the purpose, yeah. Huh?
Yeah. But, and I do think it can also encourage some pests like spider mites. I think that people with fruit inside a high tunnel struggle more with that kind of pest. So it's a tricky decision to make. And then there's folks who are growing in high tunnels that can grow fun things like peaches, you know, and sweet cherries and that kind of thing. And those probably you couldn't do outside.
So when you got botrytis, how do you guys, mitigate that for growers?
Well, with botrytis in peonies in particular, that's not something that I feel super competent in advising people. Luckily, the peony growing community is strong enough here that I think a lot of them, I usually point people towards other peony growers to just talk with amongst themselves on management practice. So I don't want to speak too much or give any misinformation on that, but I know a lot of peony growers spray different things, and some of them are organic sprays and others are not.
Yeah, we don't have any peony growers of large scale like that. That's a good segue into, like, you know, dealing with hoop houses. Hoop houses are kind of like a petri dish of infections waiting to happen, right? Like, they're just sitting there. They're the perfect atmospheric conditions for everything. And I don't think people really realize that until they get involved in it. It's just like, it's warm, it's humid, it's moist. There's lots of like hideaway, tuckaway spaces if you don't. And I think you touched on that hygiene and making sure that things are up off the ground and cleaned up around the stems and stuff are really important for people to realize. And it takes that bit of experience to know it's and to pass that on. So another practice that we just started doing here in Kodiak, and I was the first one in Kodiak to start, was low tunnel. And do you guys see a lot of those being used in your guys' experience? And where do you normally see them? Are they like inside a tunnel, the high tunnel, or are they outside the high tunnel?
Yeah, it runs the gamut, really. There's lots of backyard gardeners that are doing them on their raised beds or small garden beds with, you know, both PVC hoops or metal hoops and then plastic or like Remay, you know, Agarbon spun woven fiber or cloth. And yeah, some of the commercial growers are using them really heavily. Homer Hilltop Farm, I think, also got the NRCS practice for high tunnels, for low tunnels, and she's using them both outside and inside. So, for her early season greens, she's using Remay low tunnels inside her high tunnel, and she's planting, like, I think mid-March down in town, so super early, and then going really late, too, into, like, October. I don't know if she goes quite, into October. I don't think she goes to November, but so she's really extending her season a lot with those. And sometimes she'll do double layer of the Remay. And then she's also growing like frost hardy, you know, crops during those months. But that combination really opens up a lot of possibilities in a longer growing season for her. And then, yeah, lots of folks are also using them for pest protection, just keeping out root maggots and that kind of thing.
Yeah, that's what we have a whole lot of here is root maggots. They can devastate. They can devastate a whole garden.
I didn't even mention root maggots as a pest because they're just so ubiquitous. I don't even view them as a pest anymore. They're just a co-inhabitant.
Yeah, they're just kind of there causing havoc. But it's really good to hear that people are utilizing the low tunnel system to do IPM. It's one of the programs that I've been trying to push the hardest here in Kodiak is because not everyone can have a high tunnel in their backyard, but they can always have a small low tunnel and they can put it in. At least to me, it kind of like pairs well with the small compact gardening. When you've got small spaces and you want to extend your season a little bit to those, it just seems like it's a world-class ticket. And, you know, it's one of the better payouts that NRCS does for EQIP. And we say EQIP, but not everyone knows what EQIP is. And it would be cool to like hear what EQIP is about.
Yeah, so I believe it stands for the Environmental Qualities Incentive Program. So kind of like Soil and Water Conservation District, the Natural Resources Conservation Service is focused on natural resource concerns. That's what they kind of the term that they use. But it can be anything plant, animal, or environment related. So EQIP is just a program that provides incentives to solve these resource concerns, right? And so, for example, the low tunnel and the high tunnel program, they're actually solving soil-related problems and also plant-related problems. So oftentimes what qualifies you for a high tunnel or a low tunnel is that you have poor plant productivity because you're trying to grow a tomato outside in Kodiak or Homer. It's not going to thrive and it's going to look really tiny and stunted. And, you know, anybody can look at that and see that it's struggling. And so their prescription for that is season extension with a high tunnel or a low tunnel. But in addition to that, it's also preventing runoff. Like it's keeping... It's sheltering rains, right? So it can prevent nutrient leaching. But those are some of the main ones.
Yeah, so they're concerned with like soil quality, runoff, erosion, things. So one of the things about EQIP is that you have to apply for it. And often people, I just want to get rid of the misnomer that it's a grant. And it's not really a grant. It's a program through NRCS, which is kind of like a subsidiary of the USDA, and that a person like me would apply to become a farm, basically. And you have to fill out a bunch of paperwork, and it's a cost share, right? It's not really like they give you money. Like it's an upfront, like you have to be approved, you have to go through the processing, the approval process. And then if you're going, there's like many programs that you can apply for. And the NRCS agent will walk you through it. But one of the misnomers that we have here is that it's like a grant and it's not really a grant. And that I just want to make sure that people understand that when you apply for EQIP, it's a cost share. And what they mean by cost share is that you are going to upfront the cost and that they're going to give you a particular percentage that they have deemed, like it depends on the program. Like I think for high tunnels, it's per square foot. And you'll get a certain amount of money per square foot of your high tunnel. And it's just like with low tunnels.
So. Right. And it's like they give you that price point and then it's you're signing a contract that says that you're going to install this practice and you're going to maintain it for a set amount of time, right? For a high tunnel, I believe it's 5 years. I'm not sure for a low tunnel. So then you're responsible for installing it and then also maintaining it for those 5 years. And so that's another one of the things that an issue that some people run into is like they install the high tunnel, but then they can't keep up with the work and the upkeep of it or the snow collapses it. You can actually be liable for having to replace it on your own dime because you signed this contract that said you would have it. And I know they'll try to work with you, but like that is a risk that you take. So I don't know about you, but we advocate taking covers off of high tunnels around here because it helps so much. And it sounds like a lot of work, but once you do it, like you get a couple ladders and some friends and it really isn't that big of a deal. And then you don't have to worry about it all winter. You can go to Mexico. So.
Yeah, we don't, I personally don't advocate one way or the other. What I do tell people, like this recent, we were having this recent storm alert. And, you know, I think I told people, you know, like we're getting ready to have this mass amount of snow dumped. You might want to like clear the sides of your hoop house so that the snow doesn't pile up. And, you know, most people, I've never known anyone here in Kodiak to take their plastics off during the wintertime. It's not really a practice that I've seen all that well here. And I think it has a lot to do with like our normal snow load. We just don't get that much snow during the wintertime. Each winter obviously is a little bit different. Like we've gotten a lot of snow this year, this winter, as opposed to the winter before where we got zero. But for the most part, it's not something that we do here. I personally don't take my plastic off of my hoop house, but I do keep the sides clear so that when the snow does shed, it has somewhere to go so it doesn't like build up. Because I find that even like when you do that, even when it like slides off, it glaciates and you get like this snow stuck to the side of the hoop house. And when spring comes and you're trying to like open it up when it's like, you know, 85 degrees in there, even though it's like 30 degrees outside or something, you have to like really fight with the snow. And I just try to keep those sides cleared out. What we do tell people though, is that if your hoop house is succumbing to snow, is to cut the plastic. Like that is an option. Like that's a life-saving option to save the structural integrity, because the plastic is kind of like the cheap end of it.
Mm-hmm. I've been there. I've done it.
So it sounds like the low tunnel is off and well over there. What are people, when you look at like what we see people growing here, it's a lot of brassicas, a lot of kale, a lot of cabbage and whatnot, carrots and potatoes. What do you see as one of the biggest like normal crops everyday people grow there in their backyards?
Yeah, probably a lot of the same. All of your brassicas do really well here. The root crops do well. I would say some of them can be slightly more challenging for the beginner, just because, you know, carrots require a lot of thinning and care in the beginning of the season, and weeds can take over. And then beets in particular can struggle in soils that aren't like really optimally fertilized with all the right things. So sometimes people struggle with beets, but then if you get your soil dialed, both then your practices dialed, like both beets and carrots can do really, really well here. And then same with like rutabagas and turnips, like root maggots are a huge issue for them. And I know I've struggled. I've kind of given up on my brassica root crops because I think I fed my root maggot population for too many years and I just cannot get it under control even with crop rotation and cover and everything. But if people get that dialed, they can grow really beautiful brassica root crops as well. And then I think what other things, I think more on the high tunnel side of things, like celery and, leeks and onions, they do pretty well outside as well.
Do people overwinter those leeks? I've had growers here who grow leeks, but they just, they don't get very big the first year. And that, you know, a couple of people have told me that they've overwintered them and then they get massive, you know, the following year. And I was just curious, like, you know.
I don't know for sure if anybody is overwintering them. I tried once with some leeks that were really spindly going into the fall. And then I was hoping that might happen, but they all just bolted. So they didn't get edible. But yeah, I think other fun crops that people are growing. I mean, if you have a high tunnel or some low tunnels, you can grow just about everything. Like your beans do really well with some cover. That's actually one that I think is a really appealing choice for a low tunnel. For somebody who doesn't have the space for a high tunnel, is you could grow bush beans in a low tunnel, and I think they would do pretty well. You could also grow like bush zucchini or like really compact cucurbits, so squash or something. Pumpkins might kind of get a little too big for a low tunnel, but that's a great application for a high tunnel too.
You talked about, you mentioned about how getting your soil dialed in, and what we struggle here in Kodiak is that we don't have very great soil. It's very shallow organic, if at all. They're like where my place is, it's just basically mineral soil that's just bare ground. There's some, you know, there's some alders that's growing in there and whatnot. But for a lot of people, it's a huge struggle to get it's a huge struggle, A, because we don't have the connectivity to the mainland to be able to go get, you know, some of these ingredients that would make it quickly to make soil real quick. Like we don't really have compost that we can just go pick up and buy and throw in the, so oftentimes what people have done is that they have used everything in the kitchen sink to get organic material into a compost heap. But it's really hard to compost here because it's wet and cool for most of the year. And so people, I think, struggle with the dampness, because if you get the compost too wet, it doesn't want to heat up. And it becomes anoxic and not, it's just a slow compost. But I think that's kind of like one of the struggles that most people have, is that they do build the soil, right? And they think they're doing everything great, but then like they're still struggling with their growing. And so what, you know, like I always recommend doing a soil test. And so I know the powers of what soil tests can do for you, and what they can tell you. But maybe if you can touch on like how you view soil testing when it comes to like when you talk to growers in your neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that is one of the kind of fascinating differences between you guys and us up here, is in Homer or the Southern Peninsula in general, like we're really fortunate, we have really deep topsoils. And even if you do have, you know, not that much organic, you can bring in, like there's Anchor Point Greenhouse sells, you know, garden soil that they've made out of beech peat and other ingredients and stuff. So it's really pretty easy to get soil, even if you just want to purchase it. But even just our raw land, typically it's acidic and you have to add a lot of lime, but there's a lot of organic matter in there. Like it's a really great base that all you have to do is really start adding a few fertilizers for a year or two. And it gets to be some really nice stuff, nice loam. But like Seldovia, Port Graham, Nanwalek, they're all very rocky, very thin soils like you. And so that is a huge challenge. And, one that I haven't, you know, unfortunately, I haven't worked with a whole lot, but I have learned a little bit about sheet mulching, and I think that is a really great way to build soil. But it does take a ton of, you know, stuff, right? Like you do a layer of cardboard, and then you do your layer of browns and your layer of greens, and like where do you get all that stuff? Like kitchen scraps, you only produce so many in a year, and I think fish can be helpful, but then you have issues with bears, and like it's a challenge to get that much bulk anywhere. But that said, like I think people do a really good job. I know one grower in Seldovia that has she sells at a farmer's market there, or started the farmer's market there, and she built all of her beds up with the sheet mulching method, and she's doing really well. But she has started to test her soil, and we've noticed some interesting imbalances with her soil. And so that's where I think soil testing can really help dial those things in, because a lot of what you add to a sheet mulch or like a lasagna bed is high in phosphorus and high in potassium. And then nitrogen, there might be nitrogen in that stuff, but it's super volatile. And so it can leach away in a season, and then you're left with just high P and high K and no nitrogen. And so soil testing has helped to kind of figure out where you need to supplement and how to incorporate that. And so I think it's really helpful for that. And then some of the micronutrients too can be really important, like for beets, but really all crops thrive with high boron. And I don't know about you all, but we're really low in boron naturally in our soils here. So adding boron in the form of borax or solubor is another product is really important, but it's also toxic if you add too much. So it's like soil testing is the way to go to figure all that out.
Yeah, one of the things that I see around here is because people use a lot of beech peat, and they and it depends on like where they go to collect it. You know, the bays in which where things collect is different. You know, a lot of people in town get it at Mill Bay Beach here, which has, you know, it's mostly cut up leaves and manure. But you go further down into Women's Bay and Calson Bay and whatnot, it's cut up pretty well. But what I've noticed, at least for high tunnels, when people, I know that they've used a lot of beech peat because their boron levels are out of control. Like they've got high boron. Yeah. And I've done a lot of reading about boron, and I'm not going to get into it right here, but it appears that like that kelp is a really good, it's a really good, if you need boron, kelp is really good. It's a really good like additive if you need boron. But you're right, a little bit goes a long way. You know, I still see, you know, with high boron levels in soils, like the plant's doing just fine. And so it kind of like made me go down this research tunnel, that, maybe like high boron levels in the soil doesn't necessarily mean that the plants can have access to it. And there's like this relationship. But high boron and high salt is what we come across as high salt.
High salt.
Yeah. We get,
and then, like, this is getting into the weeds a little bit, but like a soil test will show high sodium, but that doesn't necessarily mean that it's soluble salts, the kind of salts that are really can negatively affect plants. Have you seen issues where you're having plant productivity problems because of the high salt?
Yeah, there's been about tree hoop houses that, you know, where they've used a lot of beech peat in the past, where the productivity becomes a problem. A lot of times I think that, you know, there's a lot of other problems that could mask themselves. Boron being one of them, they have very similar growing apparatuses. They look very similar. They get stunty, they get diminutive, they get weak, they get pallid, they get the burnt tips, you know, if it's boron, toxicity. Most people that I know, you know, salt is, it's not under radar. When I get their test results, it's like, oh yeah, this is classic salt burn, you know, very small stunty growth plants, that affects everything. It's not just like, and I think that this is kind of key, like it's good, you know, that the districts are around, because there's people like us that can go physically to their house. You're right. Can you imagine like them kind of call the extension service agency to like figure out what's wrong with their soil? Like that would be a nightmare. And to have people to be like, okay, well we can look at it. We can take the soil sample and whatnot. Most people have their beds outside here, which is nice because then it like washes everything away, even the boron. Like I've noticed like people who use mulch, seaweed mulch for their beds outside, their boron levels are, you know, are pretty normal. It's just the ones, the accumulation inside the high tunnels, because again, that goes back to that practice. We don't take off the plastic in the tunnels during the winter storms to allow that to water out.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. So you guys got, how many people do you have working at your office these days?
I think our district has, I think this summer we had about 18 employees at the district, but a lot of us, well, almost all of us are part-time. So, you know, we're kind of spreading the workload a little bit and have lots of other things going on. I myself have a small farm that I'm working on in the summers, and so we're not all full-time. And then a lot of them are native plants program or invasive plants program, but our agriculture program has a team of four. So our district manager, Kyra, we have an outreach coordinator, Nicole, who spreads the word on all our events on Facebook and that kind of thing. And she has a newsletter. And then myself and Victoria are the two kind of natural resource technicians. So we're doing the soil testing program and most of the technical assistance.
Oh man, it must be nice to have all that help.
It's great.
I get to do it all here. I get to do the outreach and the education, and I get to go to people's hoop houses. One of the things that I know that NRCS does for our district, mainly, my job is paid through NRCS, through a grant through NRCS. And one of the reasons for that is because the importance of representation, and their ethos is they want to get conservation practices out there everywhere. And because they don't have any representation here, that is me. And so when someone applies for like in an NRCS program, I'm the first one that goes out and like assesses the area. For high tunnels or low tunnels or what, you know, whatever practices that they are trying to apply for. I'm the one that does like on the ground reporting. Like I go out there and I map out the area. Do you guys do that over there? Do you guys inspect hoop houses for NRCS? Do you guys go out there and like when they're applying for a hoop house or something, like do you guys go out there and do like, you know, an assessment of the land and make sure that like there's crop there and whatnot?
Currently, we're not really doing that, but I'm working on my training to receive my conservation planner certification so that I could start to take some of that workload. And like our office, we used to have three planners out of the Homer office, and then I think there were three out of Kenai. And they're the ones who serve you all, I think, for the most part, as they go from Kenai to Kodiak. But, you know, with the staffing reductions this past year, we've lost, I think, two. Between Homer and Kenai, we've lost two staff members. So each office now only has two planners. And so the hope is that I might be able to help with that workload a little bit. Right now, like, we will tag along on a site visit with NRCS. Occasionally, if they have something, you know, I used to work as a forester with you. And so occasionally I'll go out and help them measure some trees or something like that. But yeah, I'm hoping to do a little bit more of that. Mostly the role we're taking is more as like a liaison between the feds and the private landowner. So occasionally people don't really want to talk to the federal government. And so we can kind of be the go-between. And we can also use language that the federal government can't use, right? Like we can recommend the brand of high tunnel or the vendor that will ship high tunnels up here. And they aren't able to do that. And so that's kind of the role we've played over the past number of years, is really just this go-between. And like, oftentimes also the first face, like sometimes people come into our office and they've heard of the high tunnel program, but they don't know anything about it. So we'll explain the program. We do occasionally do site visits for that as well. Like we can go out and be like, oh, okay, you want your high tunnel here. Well, these are the rules that NRCS is going to want to see before you can even apply, right? Like one of the things is that you have to have an established garden. You don't have to be a commercial farm. You just have to be growing some kind of food there. And so our default is like, if you haven't gardened before, your soil is probably pretty acidic and plants aren't going to thrive there anyways. So grow potatoes, because potatoes love acidic soil and they take up a lot of space. Just put a potato, and moose don't eat them. You don't have to fence it. So put a potato patch exactly where you want your high tunnel, and then call NRCS and they can come out and help check all the boxes and get you signed up. So that's kind of the role that we play.
Yeah, I find that's what we play here as well. You know, like the paperwork game for NRCS is I think for some people, absolutely, it's overwhelming. And so even though that we are not allowed to like walk them through the paperwork, but we can at least advise them like that it's not as complicated as they might think it is. And we are the local face that they come to, right? You know, at least for us in Kodiak, you know, they have to ship someone out from Kenai all the way out here that they don't necessarily know, but they know our face. So
exactly.
Cool. Well, let me start out with this. Is there anything else that you want to part words with before we go into the details?
Yeah, one more thing that I wanted to mention. We host a workshop series every winter called Know Your Land. And it's all about stewarding land and growing food. And I think this will be like our sixth year hosting it. And they're hybrid workshops. So they're in person at Kachemak Bay Campus, but they're also live on Zoom. And you can register online and get a record. You can attend live in the Zoom room, or you can get a recording afterwards. And they're open to anybody throughout the state. Last year, we had over 1,000 people participate, which was really exciting. So that series is starting on February 26th, and it'll go every Thursday at 6 p.m. for 6 weeks. So the last one is April 2nd. So if anybody in Kodiak wants to join in on those conversations, we're going to be talking. We've got High Tunnels 101. We've got a soil testing workshop. We've got one on irrigation, which is going to be taught by a commercial peony grower. So talking a little bit more about like more involved, larger scale drip irrigation systems. So that one will be really cool. And then we're going to have Lori Stewart from the Tyonic Conservation District, Tribal Conservation District, talking about salmon habitat and some of the NRCS practices around conserving salmon streams. So yeah, got some. Oh, we've got a crop rotation one too. I'm excited about that. You can follow us on Facebook. You can find us Homer Soil and Water on Facebook, and then we also have a website, homerswcd.org, and we'll be starting to roll that program out and advertising those workshops here soon. So stay tuned.
Thank you so much for being here, Monica. I really appreciate you coming in and taking the time and talking to us.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Ian. It's been great.
Listen to all the episodes of Talks Around a Farm Table on KMXT.org and Spotify. This show is in collaboration between Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District and KMXT Radio. You can find me, Ian Zacher, on Facebook at Kodiak Soil and Water Conservation District or on the web at www.kodiaksoilandwater.org. Music featured in this episode is Boil the Breakfast by The Chieftains, which is my son's favorite song.